I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
And John, I'm not trying to be too spoilery here, but I do want to say that I'm marking myself safe during Infinity War.
Nice. I still have not seen Infinity War, so please don't talk about it at all right now. And we'll have to you know, have a later date talk about that. I want to mention our guest today. It's George Beam. George has got a book out called The Military Science of Star Wars, which we're going to get into a bit later. George, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's good to be here.
George has got a fantastic little thing on his website where if you click to where it says about the author, instead of having a long bio, it just says, I write, period. A lot, period. So George, I have seen your list of books that you've written. That is an apt description of your writing. You do have a lot of books out there. Obviously, we're going to get into the Star Wars book, but maybe you could tell our listeners a little bit about some of the other kinds of books you're writing, because it's quite a diverse set of topics that you write about.
Well, that's true. I was in the process of revising my website and really didn't have a chance yet to list all of the kinds of books that I write. Mostly it's nonfiction, and half of it tends to be now business related, and the other half draw on my great interest in popular culture. And it all really started in 1989 when I did a book called The Stephen King Companion, and that set off an explosion about books about authors. And I've pretty much continued in that vein, and I wound up writing, for instance, 6 or 7 books on Stephen King. I've written about Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, Anne Rice, Philip Pullman. I really like to write about writers because I think that when you look at these best-selling writers, they have not only a great imagination, but they have the awareness that they've come up with an idea and developed it and codified it and had it grown into a universe, which is what George Lucas did. I mean, he had very, very low expectations for Star Wars as a movie. And from that first movie, it's literally, it's been a big bang. It's expanded all over the fictional universe.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, being a huge Star Wars nerd and knowing a lot about, you know, obviously we live in this world of canon and what's canon, what's not canon, all of that. And we talk about that a lot on this show. But really, when it started, I think there's this idea that Lucas had this all planned out in his head, like from day one. And that's from what I've read about it and various interviews, it wasn't that way. It was, he had it pretty well planned out, but not everything, not that was with every movie. It changed. I mean, from what I understand, you know, spoiler for a movie that's 40 years old, but you know, he didn't know right off the bat that Vader was going to be Luke's father. He didn't know that he was going to make Luke and Leia's brother and sister. It's like all these kinds of things that become part of the mythos, a lot of it was developed as he went along. And,
right.
And it's interesting. And then, and then of course, now we live in this world where there's all sorts of things like that. But obviously you've written the most, you said you wrote so much about Stephen King. What was it about him that made you want to write so much about him?
Well, for one thing, Stephen King's career has shown that he's been very prolific from the beginning. And when I first read the first King novel that I had picked up in a bookstore, which was Salem's Lot, I noticed that there was just such a confidence in his voice. And it made me think that this was not his really second book. He must have done at least several books beforehand, which turned out to be the case. when you look at, for instance, J.K. Rowling, she took 5 years to plot out Harry Potter. And so even in the first book, there are clues and little notes that are going to resonate later as the series develops. That's something that George Lucas didn't have the advantage of having done. I mean, he did the first movie. He sketched in things very quickly for the plot. He didn't know how the movie was going to be received. It was a big gamble. And it just was the right movie at the right time. And I think I speak for everyone when I say that if you're sitting there in the theater for the first time and you see Star Wars and you see the Star Destroyer come overhead, at that instant, you know that movies have changed forever. And then you look at how the technical aspects back then, 40 years ago, had been accomplished. You sit there now and say, gee, you know, that was really the beginning of how special effects took off and it became a big presence in a movie.
Well, he had to invent all that.
Yes. I mean, the Dixtraflex was a computer camera system that allowed him to make all of these turns and burns, so to speak, so that he could film and synchronize all the shots.
There's a book that Ed Catmull wrote, who's one of the Pixar guys.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I'm blanking on the title right now. I read it about a year or two ago, and it's interesting because it does coincide with that time period a little bit. A lot of the guys that, you know, they were sort of in the same area, that some of them worked for ILM and, you know, in the Pixar, they were sort of in the same world at least. And it is so, because now we kind of take it for granted what our computers can do and what our software can do. And it was a different world back then. And that how we got to the world now is a lot through what George Lucas did. And then later on with the Pixar folks and, you know, before it was even called Pixar, you know, as that mm-hmm. technology was developing. And yeah, we do take it for granted now. I'm in the middle of a big rewatch of all the Marvel movies. And I think about how, yeah, these really could not have been done until the technology got to the point where you can do all that CGI and you can pull off Iron Man and you can pull off the Hulk and all, because otherwise it would have never worked. It kind of had to wait. Now those films have been just very well made from every aspect, but if you don't have the technology to pull off a Hulk, it's not going to work.
Are you saying you didn't like Lou Ferrigno painted green and running in slow motion?
No, I did like that. I just, it's just a different thing for sure.
Did either of you see the Star Wars, the comic that they produced based on Lucas's original scripts?
I did. Yeah, I didn't read it. I'm aware of it though.
It's very different and very weird.
You mean the very first issue?
Yeah. Like they took like his original concept and script and idea and story, and they actually made a comic based on it.
Oh.
And it's completely different and very, very strange.
Well, you know, what strikes me, and I'm thinking about Lord of the Rings, the movie that came out when Tolkien, because I did a book on Tolkien, when Tolkien came up with Lord of the Rings, remember that was published back in the 50s. And, back at the time, the idea that it would be on the screen, the small screen and the large screen, was something that was the furthest thing from his mind because he knew the technology didn't exist. And it really didn't exist until fairly recently, where it got so sophisticated that it was seamless. And so now you can do comic books and have them appear on the screen in a way that is very, very convincing. And that's what's caused this enormous leap of interest in the mainstream with people, you know, the general public getting involved and becoming interested in superhero movies and Star Wars and, you know, Star Trek and all of these things. It just, the time had to be right. The story, the story and the technology had to come together.
And again, you're pointing to a director who had to be innovative and create his own technology, because just like Lucas, you know, created ILM, Jackson ended up really having a huge hand in creating Weta.
Yes.
In order to create those big battle scenes.
And they relied heavily on computers for that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they had a very interesting case where Weta was filming, trying to duplicate one character to be an army, and mm-hmm. the algorithms were set up so that it would respond in real time as to what would happen in combat. And so when they had the friendly army confronting the enemy army, when they saw the massive number of enemy coming toward them, they all turned around and retreated. So, you know, and that's realistic because, you know, the rule in combat is that, at least the U.S. Army's rule, is that when it goes into battle for a big land battle, they like to have a numerical superiority of at least 3-1, but preferably 5 or 6-1.
Wow.
You know, that's going to be our main topic, the military tactics behind Star Wars. It's a quote who I should attribute it to, but I write down all these various quotes from nonfiction books that I read. And one was, if you're in a fair fight, you didn't plan it well enough, which I think is what you're talking about there, George. You know, I want to get on to our next segment. Before we do that, I want to thank everybody who's listening, and especially the people that that are supporters of the show, that back us over on Patreon. And our Patreon is called patreon.com/functionalnerds. And thanks to all the people who back us at $1 a month or even more. And if you enjoy the show and enjoy talks with folks like George here, consider becoming one of our backers. It's patreon.com/functionalnerds. And now let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
Now, George, do you have a pick ready, or do we need to give you a minute? Because Patrick and I can go first if you need a minute.
I wanted to mention what I'm reading now because it's really research for some novels that I'm planning to write. But after a long period of time, you know, it struck me that with fiction, I have to go back periodically and reread the novels, because even with the passage of 5 to 10 years, you tend to forget a lot of the little details. So I started rereading Harry Potter, and it's a very interesting series because it's not only 7 books, but it's cumulative. What happens in the first book will telegraph what's going to happen in the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh book. And when you see how she put the story together and came to the climax, it's done just like Tolkien did with Lord of the Rings. The reason that third movie did so well and swept the Oscars is because that emotional payoff was there. We finally see all of the strings, loose strings, come together, and we have this satisfying ending. And I think that's so important, because now you've got so many writers in pop culture, especially young adult, who are rushing to write trilogies just because Tolkien wrote a trilogy. And these stories sometimes are not well thought out. It's very episodic. And so I think that's something we need to keep in mind as we discuss storytelling, because the power of storytelling really lies in the emotional impact that the story delivers. Otherwise, it's just a series of events.
Yeah, so you're going back and rereading the Harry Potter books right now?
Exactly so.
Yeah, I'm reading them for the first time right now with my son, who's 12 years old. And I had never seen, I'd seen one of the movies when it first came out, but I'd never read them before. And we're going through them fairly slowly. We're on book 4 right now, which is like the Goblet of Fire. And you're exactly right. It's the first one I read, I'm like, all right, it's fine. But with each book, it builds the world, it builds the characters, and you can tell, like, oh, I get it. Like, even by the time I got to the second book, I was like, I understand what this is all about. I understand why this is so popular, and it resonates with people so deeply. I've really been enjoying it, and it's something that I've been sharing with my son as well. So what book are you up to in your reread right now?
Well, I'm still on the first book.
Okay.
But I wanted to mention something. I was at a Harry Potter convention as a speaker, and next to me, I had 2 Harry Potter experts, real experts. And it was like 1,000 people in the audience. And they asked, the question was, is Snape a good guy or a bad guy? And at this point, I think they were halfway through the series. Rowling was halfway through the series. And the 2 experts next to me said that Snape was a bad guy. He was in cahoots with Voldemort, and that was all there was to it. And I disagreed, because I said, no. I said, Rowling has plotted this thing very carefully, and she's constantly putting Snape in the throughout the whole book. He's there for a very good reason. I said, frankly, I think that he has an unrequited love for Lily, which is Harry Potter's mother, and that tie is so deep that's going to bind the whole series together in the end. And everyone laughed. They said that was the craziest thing they ever heard, that Snape is a bad guy, and how could I think that? Well, if you're a careful reader, you get to appreciate Rowling's writing, and you get to appreciate these plot points and how they connect together. And the same thing happens now in Star Wars, because looking back, you know, they had really, it cuts in the middle. You had film one through three, then films one through three, and then you had four through six or whatever. And the first three tend to build toward a climax. And then, of course, we see this continuum where in the second set of movies, the whole story of Darth Vader comes out. And then it all starts making real sense.
Are you excited, or what do you think about the idea that they're going to do, like Rian Johnson's going to do a set of movies that have nothing to do with the Skywalkers?
You mean the A Star Wars Story kind of thing with Han Solo and what have you?
No. He's been tapped to write a whole new trilogy that has nothing to do with the Skywalkers.
Well, you know, I think that's fine. I think that when you start interpreting and reinterpreting fictional icons and movie icons like this, you're basically getting a different take on it. And that's that's still a Star Wars celebration, so to speak, as far as I'm concerned.
Nice. Cool. Yeah. Okay. Patrick, what's your pick?
My pick is, I, as John is aware, I went out on Facebook last year and was talking about getting a new game console because I hadn't upgraded in probably 10 years. And I went with a PlayStation 4. And one of the games that Ramon Terrell, our friend in Canada, who is an author and an actor, he's been in shows like Supernatural. One of the things that he recommended was a game series called Uncharted. And there is a Uncharted 1 through 3 remaster collection for the PlayStation 4. And I went ahead and got that, and I am having a ridiculous amount of fun playing that game. So that's my pick this week, Uncharted, the Nathan Drake Collection. It's a remaster of the first three games, which I think were on PlayStation 3, or possibly 2. And they have remastered them for the PlayStation 4, and it's just been a ridiculous amount of fun playing those.
Nice. My pick this week is going to be, it's a website or an app or it's a service. I don't know how you're going to call it, but it's called last.fm. And last.fm has been around for a long time. I actually used it, sad to say, almost 10 years ago for the first time.
Yeah. And I think you picked it back then too.
Yeah. It was a long time ago. I haven't used it. The last time I'd used it when I sort of re-upped it this past week was 2009, so almost 10 years ago. It's essentially just tracks the music that you're listening to. You install an app on your phone, and then whatever you listen to on your phone, it sort of keeps track of. And I really like doing that. And I'd stopped using it because years ago because it was with like an iPod, and the technology wasn't quite there yet, and it was more frustrating to try to get it to work than it was enjoyable to sort of track your stats. So I don't know. I come across it again. I'm like, you know, let me try that now. I bet the technology has improved and you don't have to mess with it as much. And you don't. And it's worked seamlessly. And I've enjoyed sort of looking back on the week and seeing like, oh, I listened to this band 10 times and I listened to this artist, you know, 12 times or what have you. It's essentially like a Goodreads for music. It just kind of keeps track of your stuff, but it's a way to sort of find new artists too. And I really kind of see myself kind of delving a little more into it. I get into keeping track of this stuff. I don't know why, I just do. But it works great right now. So that's you don't have to think about it. You just open it up and kind of see what you did. So I've been enjoying it. Once you just go to last.fm, that's the website. You sign up for an account, you sort of sync it with whatever music service you use, and it should work for you depending on your device and service. So that's my pick, last.fm. Now, getting back to George here. George, you were in the military and you mentioned that. Can you tell us a little bit about when, how long you were in the military and, you know, just a little bit about your experience in the military, which I'm sure influenced the writing of this book?
All right. I was in the military for about 18 years. I was on active duty initially, which is necessary when you become commissioned as an officer. You have to go off to a service school and learn the basics. And after that, I spent a long stint with the National Guard, also in a field artillery unit. And then I was with the Army Reserve after that, more as a staff officer. And so basically my whole experience in the military has been principally in the Army, although I also took Naval ROTC in high school, and my father was career Air Force, so I was fairly familiar with the military life and moving and being close to military installations like Langley Air Force Base, which is now fairly close to where I live.
Now, when did you start writing? Were you writing while you were in the military? Did you start writing before that?
Well, I had my first book published right after graduating from college. When I was in college, I was working on a book by an artist named Vaughn Bodie. And he unfortunately died he died in 1975. And that's pretty much when the book was finished. So he annotated it and he died. What was interesting about Vaughn Bodie is that a lot of people don't know who he is now. He's a cartoonist, but he was a very visionary cartoonist. And one of the things I point out in my book is that much of what Vaughn imagined in terms of military hardware was actually things that we wound up developing, you know, 40 years later, 50 years later. He imagined a lot of these remote control mech devices, flying machines, drones, mech infantry in a way that just now our technology is allowing us to develop these in the real world.
And were you a full-time writer while you were in the military? Were you doing both concurrently, or did you kind of start focusing on, you know, your sort of your full-time writing after your service?
It was pretty much concurrent because I had a lot of things that I had wanted to write, and I started out writing about artists, and then I started switching to nonfiction and writing about different writers. But the military has been a constant strain, and I think anyone that's been in the military will find that, you know, the time that they spend is going to be useful for many, many things later. Actually, in terms of population, only 1% of the American public have ever been in the military. And so one reason I wanted to write my book was to explain a little bit about the military culture, because it always aggravates me when I see movies, especially pop culture movies, and you see all these actors and they're wearing, you know, like the Eagle symbol on their fatigues, which is the rank insignia for a full colonel. And you just see them walking around, you know, stiffly and barking orders. And I thought, geez, you know, this isn't how it is. And I had, for instance, 2 weeks with a F-16 fighter wing in New Mexico one time, and I was advising them on ground tactics that the Army uses, and we were talking about close air support and having classes and things. And I was joking with them about Top Gun, and I said, how realistic is Top Gun? And these are combat pilots whose area of operation is the Middle East, and a lot of them were on station for the Gulf War and whatnot, and, you know, and took out Saddam Hussein, and they just laughed and laughed. They said, you know, you can't look at what happens in popular culture and think that it's an accurate assessment or depiction of what happens in the real world. And so, for instance, when you go to the flight line or you come off the flight line, there's no jumping up and bumping chests and high-fiving and stuff like that. These guys are quiet professionals. They suit up. You put your suit on. You climb into your F-16. You get strapped in. You know, it's all business. And there's a little joking afterward when everything's done and the mission's done. You've had the mission debriefing. But the depiction of the military in movies is generally very misleading. And I think people should know that.
You mean there's no shirtless beach volleyball?
Well, you know, I was going to ask where the volleyball court was, but these guys really weren't interested in that. But it is funny because, you know, it's New Mexico. And I thought what you guys need to do is put a big speaker underneath one of these F-16s and go real low and real fast over some of these UFO hunters that are sitting there at night with binoculars saying, surrender earthlings, give them something to really talk about.
And do you think that they do those changes a little bit for dramatic effect or for entertainment effect?
No, I think they do it because they don't take it seriously. I feel like if you have the military aspects of a movie and have it more accurate, it enhances the storytelling. It makes the story better. And an example I like to use is in the first Star Wars movie. So you have a situation, the climax of the movie is at the very end, Luke is making the bombing run on the Death Star. And you've got a general sitting on a moon that's going to be obliterated in minutes, and he's basically conducting this air war. And so Luke is sitting there, you know, in his little starfighter, and it's shaking up and down, and Darth Vader's on his butt, you know, firing away at him. And then suddenly he hears a voice, and it says, "Luke, use the Force." And so Luke thinks about it and says, "Yeah, that sounds like a good idea." Knocks and it turns off his targeting computer. It retracts, and the general on the ground is panicking. He's saying, "Luke, you turned off your computer. What's wrong?" And he says, "Oh, nothing." And you know, it struck me that the better way to have done that is to have it redone so that you've got Darth Vader taking out R2-D2 and taking out this targeting computer, and so Luke has no options. And the clock is running out, and he doesn't know what to do. And he knows that if he takes a blind shot, he's probably going to miss, because you need to have that a computer or something to guide that proton torpedo into the exhaust port. And then finally, Luke hears that voice and says, "Luke, use the Force." And then he trusts that and uses it. And the reason that's important is that, for instance, you know, if you're planning an air battle, or in fact a land battle, there's a lot of things going on that the smaller players, or the pilots in this case, aren't going to know about. There's a big picture, and they're a cog in that picture. And so if you're the ground commander, the air commander, looking at this battle on this computer 3D whole screen, you're thinking, you know, is Luke suffering from hypoxia? Is he having oxygen deprivation? Is he hallucinating? You know, there's all sorts of things that can happen in a fighter jet that will affect your judgment. And so, you know, my thinking is, if you have the military stuff integrated properly into the storyline, you're going to have a more convincing movie.
Now, could you give an example, not necessarily of Star Wars, but a movie that people would know where you think the military aspect of it is done right?
Well, when I think of Avatar, I think there's a lot of interesting things that go on in there in terms of the military. I think it does show, well, actually, I don't want to use Avatar. I want to use Lord of the Rings. There's a scene where there's a battle and the orcs are advancing on a fixed installation, which is where King Theoden is. And it's a defensive situation where they're going to have an overwhelming force out there. And the orcs have planned this battle. And the thing to remember is that in combat, the advantage always goes to the offensive team. It always goes to the one that's got the football, so to speak, and trying to get across the goal line. And so the orcs have very carefully mapped out what they're going to do to assault this fortress. And it's textbook. It's perfect. It's exactly how you would plan something like this. What's unrealistic is that you have someone like Gandalf at the end rise up, you know, and then he's got all these horsemen behind him, and they come down and they create havoc, and all the orcs scatter and whatnot. In real life, the orcs would have a battle plan to address any kind of sudden intrusion of another force from a different flank, and they would deal with it. But in terms of how that battle unfolded, it was the classic thesis-antithesis. The orcs do something, the defenders do something to repel them. The orcs try another thing, the defenders try another thing. The orcs put a sapper in, blow up a wall, and then, of course, things are going to take their natural course. So I think if you study the Lord of the Rings movies, in many ways, I think that's pretty accurate. And that's because Tolkien himself was a veteran, and he was in World War I. And he saw what happened in the war, and he saw the loss of so many of his friends. And you find that Lord of the Rings is just permeated with this enormous sadness at the loss of so many lives needlessly. And that's what makes, for instance, Lord of the Rings to me so memorable, because at the end of the book, you don't have this, well, we won and let's go off and let's go to the tavern and have a beer. They don't do that. It's the scouring of the Shire, which is a brilliant scene. And George R.R. Martin talks about it a lot as being a key inspirational scene for him as well. Because in the scouring of the Shire, as you remember, the heroes come back and they think, oh, you know, this is great. We won the War of the Ring. And they come back and they find that their little place called the Hobbiton far away was also affected, that nothing was unaffected by the war. The war had tentacles that reached out all over the world, even their little corner that they thought was safe from the war. And that pretty much is how World War II was. I mean, it reached out and it encompassed the entire globe. And so I think Lord of the Rings is a very good movie to watch, where a lot of the military aspects were accurate, because you have to remember, the technology is always changing, and you're always hoping to improve your technology to give you a combat edge. But in the end, you're going to deal, as we're finding out now in the military, you're dealing with the Russians and the Chinese, who have very comparable armies and very good technology. And so you're dealing with what we call parity. And you're going to, now the U.S. military is looking for ways to give them a fighting edge, and they're going to use technology, because you get these large land battles together, and what's going to make the difference is not necessarily the technology, but the tactics and the strategies, because somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. And if they're evenly pitted, it's all going to be about leadership. And that's what the military is all about. It's all about commanding. It's all about command leadership and the people at the top and the chain of command that goes all the way down to the bottom, from the president of the United States down to the lowliest private. And this is one of the big faults that I have with Star Wars, is that there's never a chain of command. So when the bad guy, at the very top, whoever Darth Vader or Rilo Ken reports to, whenever they die, everything tends to just fall apart, because there's nobody designated to say, okay, if I die, then you take my place. And if he dies, someone else takes his place. In the military, you do have literally this chain that extends all the way down, so that someone is always in charge and accountable for what's happening on the battlefield.
Now, George, I think your book focuses entirely on the films, but I was thinking, while you were just talking about the chain of command there, there is the Clone Wars cartoon series, and I don't know if that's mentioned in the book or not, or if you...
It's really not. What I do is, when I write a book, I have to think in terms of having the largest possible audience. And so my thinking is that most people, for instance, my wife, will have seen the movies, but they will not necessarily be aware of this enormous infrastructure that we call canon. Mm-hmm. So they're not necessarily going to watch the cartoons or read the novelizations or read the comic books. You know, I have to write for the largest possible audience. And this means focusing on the films, which most people will be familiar with. Mm. But the minute I start talking about something more esoteric in canon, I'm going to lose a lot of these people.
Sure. Well, I want to lose people. no, I was going to mention that there is a great arc. Some of the in that Clone Wars cartoon, where they do focus on the actual clones and sort of the military life of the clones. Mm-hmm. There's a great arc either in season 4 or 5, where it's like a 4 or 5 episode arc that is focused entirely on the clones and on this one campaign. And there is a Jedi general who does happen to fall to the dark side.
He's a dick.
Yeah.
He's a dick.
And it's basically that question of, they're following his orders, but they know something's up, and it's a struggle for them, because some of them want to keep following, 'cause that's what they're supposed to do. And some of them are questioning his judgment and whether he should be doing. And then, you know, of course, it turns out that he's fallen. Mm-hmm. But it's a really interesting question that, that goes along with what you're talking about. And I think those are some of the best episodes in that series, the ones that really focus on the military aspect of the clones.
Right, because see, there what you have is you have a moral conflict.
Yes.
And in the military, we are not necessarily, how can I put it? If it's an unlawful order, we don't have to do it. And this is why when the CIA is saying, you know, we're going to torture these people and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, the military people are sitting back and saying, well, gee, you know, I don't know if we should or shouldn't. It's a morality play. And it reminds me really, and a perfect example of this is Lieutenant Calley in the, during the Vietnam War. He went in and he had gotten orders to clean out this village. And he went in and simply massacred all the civilians. And, you know, there was no fact finding. There was nothing going on. They just went in there and started rocking and rolling with their M16s. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that is so costly, because that's going to wind up really hurting your credibility with the people, with the civilians. And this is a big, big issue, because in war, you're always going to have what we call collateral damage, which is accidental damage to buildings, facilities, vehicles, but people as well. And when you start doing that, you really wind up taking a situation that's bad and making it worse. For instance, with Guantanamo Bay, when you start torturing and interrogating people that are there, and then you finally let them out, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to become, if they weren't terrorists before, they're going to be terrorists now.
And I'm curious now, kind of to get it back into military and science fiction, is there a military science fiction series or novel that you feel does get military right?
Yes. There's one book that's been published that I think is absolutely brilliant. It's by a Vietnam veteran who was a combat engineer. And his name is Joe Haldeman. And the book that he wrote is called The Forever War. It's been optioned for movies. It hasn't been developed yet. But, you know, you probably remember the abortion that was called Starship Troopers. The first one was bad. The second one was worse. I mean, it was just, you know, I mean, Robert Heinlein, you know, was a great science fiction writer. You know, I met him in person at the Worldcon. He and I had exchanged some letters and postcards because he loved to talk to young people who were in the military. And it turned out that he had been where I had been stationed. And so we were talking about that. And so I thought, you know, when they come out and do Starship Troopers, what a great idea, what a great movie it's going to be. And it turned out to be just awful, just screamingly bad. And I hope that when Hollywood finally brings the Forever War to the screen, they follow the storyline very carefully, because it's an absolutely brilliant exegesis and an explanation of what war is really like. You know, it's not the glamour of war, which is just wrong to write about, but it's about the tediousness of war, the futility of war, the hopelessness of war, the drudgery of war. It's things that you see from the viewpoint of the poor, bloody infantryman, as Robert Heinlein would put it. And that's a book that I would highly recommend to all of our listeners.
That's one that comes up a lot. I feel like when the sort of best books in that particular genre come up, I feel like that one does come up quite a bit. Patrick, have you read that one?
I have not. It's on my to-be-read list.
I think I even have it. I believe because it's been recommended so many times, I feel like at one point it was a Kindle Daily deal and I bought it. So I feel like I have it sitting on my Kindle, mm-hmm. and I certainly do want to get over to that. You know, so George, as we start to wind down and wrap this up, you know, so people, your book, when was it published? I feel like it's been out for a couple of weeks now, correct?
Yes, it just came out. It took me about a year to write. And what I really wanted to do is I had two goals with the book. First, I wanted to talk a little bit about the military, and then I wanted to relate it to Star Wars. And what I didn't want to do is get into this endless debate and discussion about strategy and tactics. I think that's always fun and that's always very interesting, but it's a part of this large, what we call this whole military community. And so I wanted to explain in the real world what things are like, what it's like to be in the military, what it's like to serve, what it's like to live in a closed ecosystem, which is what the military is. And there's a great deal in Star Wars that resonates with me because, you know, the whole premise of Star Wars is that word wars. Without that, you would have, you know, if you did a series called Star Wars during peacetime, you wouldn't have as many viewers because you have to have that conflict. And what makes the Star Wars movies great in terms of popular culture is that you've got believable characters and they have these, you know, I mean, these characters have had this long life, fictional life that go all the way back to the first movie, which was what, 77, 78?
Yeah, 77, yeah.
It was, yes, that's right, 77. And, you know, it's like there's a continuum with and history with these guys. You know, everybody knows who Han Solo is and Leia. And these are characters that we, you know, especially if you see them when you're a young child, as one, at least one of you did, you just see, remember them fondly because that was part of your childhood or it was part of your life when you were young. And you remember that.
Mm. Yeah, it's I think the military angle is certainly interesting. I know in the school that I teach at, there's a military base. I would say about 20% of the students in my school are from this one military base. So it's something that that I deal with quite a bit.
Which base is that?
It's a Picatinny Arsenal. I live in New Jersey, so it's it's that base there. So it's, you know, I know a little bit about that life just because those students are cycling in and out, you know, they're there for two or three years and then they move on. And so there's always big turnover in the school that I teach at. And that's a big thing for those kids to do. That's their life. They're used to it, but it's still, there's a lot of, their issues. There's things that they have to deal with because of that, or because their mom or dad is, because there's a lot of women that are serving as well, and a lot of the that they're away, and then they come back. So yeah, it's interesting. So I hope the book does well for you because it seems like a really great topic to write about. Before we do wrap up, so now once again, the book is The Military Science of Star Wars. It's available now. Is it? Now, obviously, it's going to be in hardcover or, you know, print and ebook. Is it going to be a audiobook too, or just print and ebook for now?
It's available in all three editions. And if somebody goes to my website, georgebeam.com, they can listen to a sample of the audio, which is read by a wonderful reader. He's such a wonderful reader that he read the introduction to the book as well as the entire text of the book. And then I went in and recorded a back end piece, which was a question and answer interview. So the book is available in all formats, in all bookstores, all the normal places online. And it's print, it's trade hardback.
Nice. Really good. Yeah, because obviously our listeners are into the audio. So I'm sure a lot of them will pick it up that way. Any conventions that you're going to be making an appearance at coming up?
Well, there will be a couple. First, I am going to the San Diego Comic-Con, which is a Nerdvana. And they're going to be giving away on Twitter, I think, several copies of my book. I don't know how that works out, but I'm going to go there and sign them and maybe hang around the booth every once in a while and talk to people at the Comic-Con that show up at the booth. I'll also be at the Decatur Book Fair, which is going to be near Atlanta, and it's going to be in early September, and they're going to have a panel about Star Wars, and I'm going to be on the panel. So that should be a lot of fun. I don't know who else is going to be on the panel, but it's nice to see this kind of celebration of Star Wars come to the mainstream in such a way that we can go to a book festival and have a discussion about Star Wars. That's a big change.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's fantastic. Well, George, thank you so much for your time. For us, once again, if you enjoy the show, consider becoming one of our backers over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. Patrick, anything you want to leave our listeners with today?
Well, just for George's benefit, where I live in Colorado, I am about 45 minutes from the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. And I live probably 5 minutes away from Buckley Air Force Base. So military culture is all around me here.
Well, and the thing that I want to point out is that the culture has changed. There's been a sea change in how the public treats and perceives about people in the military. And I remember after the Vietnam War, and I had served right after that, and during when I was in college, the war was going on. But the way that the military people were treated was reprehensible. The idea was that we shouldn't have been in Vietnam, and the public took it out on the personnel who served. And now, if you're in the military, you're celebrated. And I think it's because of this simple realization. I was reading a book, and it talked about all of these wives that were getting together, and Air Force wife was there as well, because she was working there part-time. And all of these wives were talking about their husbands and how they were salesmen and how they were killing the competition. And this was not a battle. This was a war. And talking about how brave their husbands were. And finally, this Air Force wife stood up and she said, I've listened to all of you guys talk about war and casualties and death and battles, and it's all about sales. You're killing the competition. She says, the difference is my husband is an Air Force pilot. He gets in an F-16 jet. When he goes off and flies, even in peacetime, there's a possibility he may not come back if the plane malfunctions. In wartime, that goes up. I don't know if he's going to come back in the door at the end of the day. You guys don't have to worry about your husbands, but I do. And that underscores the fact that the military is a very serious occupation. And so for me, having lived through a time period where the military was treated poorly and perceived poorly, to see them being celebrated now is a wonderful thing.
Well, that's a great point to end on there. Well, George, thank you again for your time. Best of luck with the book and all your con appearances. And we'll see everybody next week.
All right. This is a lot of fun, guys.
Sunsmoke. I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves. And I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?
I'm the one in the middle.